Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. Welcome back to Still Dreaming, an existential wandering through our forever night. So what's in store for this evening? This is the 11th episode of Season 1, titled Hunters, and originally it aired on September 29th, 1992. It was directed by Michael Levine and written by Peter Mitchell. Levine, by the way, also directed Dance by the Light of the Moon, which I was not overly impressed by. I'm happy to say that this week's outing is much better. So let's get to the synopsis, as always, from Wikipedia. When someone murders Skanky's old partner, Jeanette allows Nick to hide Skanky at her nightclub, The Raven, putting Nick in mind of his own escape from vampire hunters with Jeanette and Lacroix. So I gotta say, folks, I liked this one. It's a Skanky-centered episode, but Skanky is, I mean, get this, actually written well. We get some insight into him, there's some decent action, like, it's a good episode. So, generally the theme in this episode is kind of loosely about turning the tables, hunted becoming a hunter, as we'll see. There's a few things also about being a good person, morality and ethics, but I've been talking a lot about that in these past few episodes, so I'm taking a slightly different tack on this one. Instead, we'll be taking a more general approach to the existentialist idea of human nature and authenticity, and examining whether or not we think Skanky acts in an authentic way, or if he acts in bad faith. With this, I'll be taking a broad approach. Sources will be in my show notes, as always. So with that, let's get to the cold open. When the episode begins, we're doing a long walk and talk down a busy street. Knight and Skanky are talking to someone dressed as a rejected extra from Miami Vice. This is Skanky's old partner, Jimmy. They were partners for 4 years, and we get some banter. Skanky's nickname used to be Donut. All right, Donut Donnie it is. Jimmy is being offered a promotion, some daytime commander or something like that. Stonetree sent Knight and Skanky to talk Jimmy into accepting it, but Jimmy's adamant. He's not interested in homicide, and he's not interested in daytime desk jobs. There's some ball-busting between him and Skanky, and I like the scene overall. It seems genuine enough. The sex workers and drug dealers on the street behind them are a bit laughable, a mishmash of late 80s, early 90s exaggerated fashion on a group of mostly white folks mildly intermingling so as not to distract from the speaking characters. At the end of the block is the caddy, and Jimmy and Skanky trade a few more barbs, and Jimmy tells Donnie he's lucky to have his wife, he does, and then bang! Jimmy is shot! Everyone scrambles, and we cut the opening credits. So I gotta say, this is a nice opening. We get introduced to Jimmy, and while he's definitely vice cop cliche, I like the banter between him and Skanky and Nick. When we come back from the credits, the cops and Natalie are there. The street is blocked off. Nat and Nick talk as they walk down that street, and already I like that we have some movement in this episode. The direction is really good. We learned that the shooter was on top of a nearby building. It was a one shot, one kill, so this tells us he was a good marksman. The shot composition of the scene brings Skanky in focus in the foreground, just as Nick and Natalie finish their exchange on the sidewalk in the background. It's just some nice blocking, good composition. I'm mentioning all of this because it seems a little more polished than in previous episodes. Stonetree gives Skanky a hug, but Donnie is stone-faced. The chief tries to send him home, but Skanky's not having it. He's going to figure out who killed Jimmy. Nick supports Donnie's request, and so far I am liking Skanky here. He's not ranting or going off half-cocked. Not that I think that cops should ever think of their duty as vengeance, of course, but they're giving Skanky some gravitas in this scene, and I do appreciate that. Stonetree has a nice little speech to dissuade Donnie from getting too aggressive. He agrees to let him and Knight take the lead on the investigation, warning Nick to keep an eye on Skanky, and warning Skanky that this all better be done by the book. So, would I be fine with this in a real life situation? Fuck no. Am I okay with this in a vampire cop TV show? Fuck yes, you go get him, Skanky. We cut to the caddy. Donnie's telling stories about working with Jimmy. It's a somber scene, grounded, and a good performance. At the station, there's an exchange with a woman. Her name is Norma. She's behind the reception desk at the station. There's a problem with the computer system. I wonder if that'll be relevant later. Nick wants copies of Jimmy's vice cases and to talk to some of the detectives from that division. Norma gives Skanky his mail, and there's a little bit of a banter about a police newspaper that Donnie is subscribed to. That'll actually be relevant later, so we'll make note of it. There's also just a plain envelope, and in it we find a photo of Skanky holding Jimmy's body just after he was shot, with a target drawn on his face. Holy shit, that's creepy. I mean, I don't buy for one hot second that the shooter lined up this perfect shot, assassinated a detective, put down his rifle, picked up his camera, already loaded with black and white film, lines up Skanky in the viewfinder, gets him in perfect focus, and snaps a pic all in the few seconds that would have been necessary for him to get that shot of Skanky still holding Jimmy's body. But you know, as a narrative device, it works. So, as we've established, this episode is about Skanky. Nick, of course, is an important character in it, but this is Skanky-centric. So let's talk about him for a minute. I'm fond of pointing out that the series is rather inconsistent with Nick's partner. He's often the butt of jokes, and occasionally seems competent, but not infrequently he's made to look like a buffoon. The series quickly established a trope where Skanky gets knocked down, knocked out, or otherwise incapacitated just before the climactic showdown at the end, rendering him useless. Now, this episode goes a long way towards remedying some of those elements, while not actually completely ignoring what came before. Skanky in this episode can still be egotistical, still be a bit of a blowhard, and still have a quick temper. But he's also shown as having dedication, being reasonable, making good decision, being, dare I say it, a good dick. This episode really helps us flesh out the character and gives the actor, John Kapolos, some really good material to work with. In a broader existentialist view, Skanky could be regarding as existing in what Kierkegaard might call the ethical mode of living, dedicated to a greater social good and social-based ethics. Because he's a person, and thus not perfect, his morality is sometimes impinged by other factors. He clearly and repeatedly in the series identifies strongly with his role as a cop and all the intricate sub-identities that that comes with. To take a Sartrean approach, we might ask if Skanky lives his life authentically. I suggest that there are indications that he does not, that he lives in what Sartre would call bad faith. For example, remember episode 3, where he attempts to pick up women at the Raven in an attempt to prove his virility and masculinity. And while not successful in his exploits, he later seeks forgiveness and repentance for his acts, admitting guilt and regret. What we saw in that episode was a man acting in bad faith, pretending at a deeply flawed but idealized notion of masculinity, subduing his own natural instincts. But that was a pretty obvious example. So what can we make of Donnie's behavior in this episode? When we come back to the show, we cut to Stonetree's office. He suggests Skanky and his wife and daughter get out of town for a few days with police protection. Donnie humors the idea of sending Mira and Jenny off, but he's adamant that he's not leaving. Now here, I do think we see Skanky acting authentically. We don't get a sense that he's putting on a front, that he's pretending. We see him act with conviction and assuredness. That this also aligns with conventional tropes of bravery is not an issue in Sartre's notion of authenticity. What matters is freedom and choice and responsibility. Flashback time. Horses galloping through the woods. It's broad daylight. It's a wide shot, so we can't see the faces, but the riders have smoke billowing out from under their cloaks, so pretty good indication it's our trio of vampires. They're being chased close behind by other men on horseback deeper into the woods. Our trio are literally leaving a trail of smoke behind them. The pursuers seem to gain ground. One of our group falls behind and crawls out, revealing that it's Jeanette. Nick stops his horse and turns around to her. The third, Lacroix, stays up front. Jeanette claims, "I can't go on." "Oh, okay, so why'd you stop your horse?" "It's not a vampire horse. Just hold on. It'll keep running." She turns to Nick and tells him, "Leave me behind." "Oh, what? Why'd you call him back to you then?" So Lacroix angrily tells Nick to just leave her. And, well, I kind of understand the sentiment. I mean, still, damn, that's cold, Lacroix. Lacroix spurs his horse on. Nick tries to lead Jeanette's horse while still riding his. We cut to some abandoned-looking house or shack. Our trio storms in and uses whatever ramshackle furniture is there to block the doors. A quick line from Jeanette tells us that they let the horses run off to try to fool the pursuers. Things are tense, and then a shot rings out and hits Lacroix. The hunters have found them. Holy shit, folks. This flashback was awesome. I really liked this one. It was kind of lengthy, for one, and wonderfully shot action. Horseback chases, guys. Horseback chases. And for once, it's not our Nick standing around looking sad, or Jeanette and Lacroix strutting around gloating about how superior they are. There's some real peril. They're in trouble. And again, just, there's movement, dynamicism. I really like seeing that. It's something different. We cut away from the flashback to the station again. We're walking through the station, and Nick's trying to talk Skanky into lying low. They end the conversation in front of the reception desk, where the computer system has apparently been fixed, and a repair guy is talking to Norma. So they're calling our attention to this again. Must be important. We cut to Nick and Donnie arriving at a motel. We didn't slip into some fanfic here, did we? No. Nick's trying to get Skanky to lie low for a while. As they walk away from the caddy, an ominous blue car slows down in the intersection behind them. We can't make out who the driver is, but he's watching the detectives. Again, some nice blocking, camera movement. Everything's just really good in this episode. Hard to believe that this same director also did Dance by the Light of the Moon, which was just, well, not good. Anyway, in the hotel room, a uniformed cop is there to be Skanky's protection. So we have a young uniformed police officer, Nick and Skanky, in the hotel room. There's a little bit of light banter, and shit, this is seeming like it's the beginning of some slash fic. Thankfully, before anyone can be swept into Nick's manly arms, an ominous figure emerges from the ominous blue car outside. We cut back to the hotel room. Chinese food has been ordered. Nick makes the takeoff, but Donnie asks him to stay and have a meal with them. And as he says this, he's taking off his tie and unbuttoning his shirt, and the younger cop is just behind him, and Nick says he'll stay, but only to watch. Oh, Jesus Christ, I was joking about the fan fiction. Stop it. We cut back outside the window and see a hand place a gun on the windowsill. The hand pushes the window up. We cut back to the hotel room, and a shot of empty Chinese food containers tells us some time has passed. Everyone, thankfully, still has their clothes on. Skanky starts rambling about women, of course. Back at the windowsill, the hands are now placing plastic explosives? What the fuck? Inside, Nick finally leaves. He promises to talk to Donnie's wife and let her know that he's okay. Skanky, now alone with the uniformed cop, is pursuing the TV guide, while the ominous figure finishes placing the bomb in the wires. And I'm not exactly sure where this is supposed to be located. Does the back of the motel room have a window? I mean, this is obviously not by the front door. Is this a bathroom window? Anyway, Nick is walking back to his car when kaboom! Fireball! Big fucking explosion. I mean, holy shit. Maybe this is why we've had music montages and cheap-ass looking sets in previous episodes. They spent all their money on this episode's horse chases and explosions. So Nick screams out Skanky's name, and we cut to commercial. When we come back, Nick has run into the motel and he pulls Skanky out, but the uniformed cop is dead. There's actually kind of a nice little scene. It's short, but it works. Both actors doing a really good job. Which is why it sucks that the makeup on Skanky just makes him look like a Looney Tunes character who had Acme Dynamite blow up in his face. A bit later, at the aftermath, ambulances and cops are there. Nick confirms it was plastic explosive on the bathroom window. Skanky is getting treatment by a medic, but honestly, I think I've looked worse just sitting too close to a campfire. The acting is still really good, though. Nick and Donnie talk it through. The only thing they can come up with is that somebody in the precinct is involved, giving out info. Donnie is understandably upset. If there's an insider, where can he hide? Cut to the Raven. Nick is talking to Jeanette, who does not want Skanky to hang out there, but Nick says he's a target and she should understand that. And that brings us to a flashback. So the trio is trapped in the shack. And one of the hunters pierces the rickety walls with a flaming spear. Nick grabs the spear and pulls the man through the wooden boards, grabs him, and kills him. No mercy, Lacroix tells him. And nice, you know, I've been saying for a while now I wanted to see Nick actually kind of be dark and violent to give us some contrast, and I'm getting it here. Cut back to present time at the Raven. Jeanette relents. Nick warns Skanky to keep his hands to himself, but in kind of a light-hearted way. Skanky's been through the ringer, and we get a sense that he knows he doesn't belong here, but he's gonna have to behave because his life depends on it. It's sunrise, and we're at the lair. Nick is on a laptop, and it's massive because it's 1992, and probably has less computing power than my out-of-date Xiaomi cell phone does. There's a couple floppy disks on the table, I notice. Natalie's there, and they're going over Skanky and Jimmy's files when they were working together. Things are tense. Nat tries to lighten the mood with a joke, but Nick's not really having it. Daytime at the Raven. The club is closed, and only Donnie is there. He's bored, and he's doing stupid human tricks to entertain himself, including playing quick draw with his gun and dancing around the floor. You know, I get it, he's bored out of his mind, and he's also anxious as all fuck, but can we not make him into a buffoon? I really like this version of Skanky we're getting in this episode. Let's not mess it up. Eventually, out of boredom, he calls Nick. He makes an offer to be bait to try to trap the hunter. In the background, while he's talking, a woman walks through the club. Skanky cuts the call short. He follows the woman down some stairs into a storage area, but he doesn't see her right away. He checks out some of the things in storage, wine bottles without labels. He sees a coffin on a shelf. To his credit, he doesn't actually go near it. He hears a noise and goes further back into the storage area. And how fucking big is the Raven, anyway? He hears something behind a door, but before he can open it, Jeanette is there and stops him. She talks him away from the door, and he asks her about the coffin. "Oh, that old thing," Jeanette says. "We cater to the occasional fetishist." And I about busted out laughing. She sends Skanky back to the main bar, and she returns to the door he was about to open. The woman we saw earlier is in there, hanging upside down, like a bat. Jeanette assures her and others not to worry about the outsider in their midst. Okay, this is a little weird. So the Raven is a vampire boarding house? Why are they hanging upside down like bats? Nick doesn't sleep that way. Does Jeanette sleep that way? I mean, the scene isn't terrible, but I don't know. Sunset, and we're at the station. Nick is getting a printout of more data from Donnie's and Jimmy's time as partners. There's some dialogue about the computer system and how Norma just has to enter a batch number to pull up exhaustive records on any given cop. She enters Nick's batch number, 16596. But there are no files older than a couple years, which is really weird and unexpected to Norma, given that he's a homicide detective who would presumably have a long career with at least some police agency before, and there's no medical history or police records. She asks what police force he was with before, but Nick squirms and gets out of there before he can give an answer. At the Raven, Skanky is talking to Jeanette, and he's rambling, but his rambles in this episode aren't as annoying as they've been in previous episodes, and they're actually forgivable given that he's scared for his life and feeling caged up. He does keep calling her Janet, and she corrects him. She's humoring him, and I do actually like Deborah Duchenne's performance in the scene. We get another flashback from Jeanette this time. The hunters are entering the cabin, but Nick violently dispatches them one by one. When we come back to the present time, apparently Jeanette is telling Skanky the story, only in her revising, it's a Chicago gang that had them trapped, and Nick took them on. "I've never seen him so violent," she says. Skanky is shocked to hear this about his partner. And I really love this overlap between Nick's vampire worlds and his human worlds. I want to see Skanky and Natalie dip their toes into this arena. Let some of Nick's darker secrets slip. So let's pause for a moment to consider a few things. For Jean-Paul Sartre, existence precedes essence. That's ultimately the very core of existentialism. To try to explain this in a simple way would be to say that a person's life has no predetermined fate, value, or purpose. We exist first. Then we determine our fate, our values, our purpose. Most existentialism is atheistic, with exceptions, notably Kierkegaard. And so without the divine serving as an arbiter of values or source of ethics, the responsibility for who we are and how we act is totally, radically free. Moreover, we do not choose to exist. We do not will ourselves into being. But nonetheless, we and only ourselves are solely responsible for our actions. To say our actions are determined by divine will, or to say I do a thing because it's only proper, or, well, that's just what one does, that is to live in bad faith, by denying one's own freedom and responsibility. I bring this up at this point to make a couple of points. First off, about Skanky. In the series, Skanky isn't depicted as being a particularly deep thinker. I'm not saying he's dumb, but only that the show generally portrays him as someone who values gut instinct, derived from experience, rather than careful reflection. On the one hand, such a person is very likely to pursue an authentic state of living. He does what strikes him as genuinely right and correct, without overthinking his place or the outcomes. Being thus true to himself, he lives an authentic life of action. On the other hand, we have in fact seen Skanky do things for appearances. He is clearly concerned about maintaining the image of a tough detective, a man's man, etc. Sartre states quite directly in his essay, Existentialism is a Humanism, that, quote, there is no human nature, end quote, and that, quote, man simply is, end quote. To some degree, we all live in bad faith sometimes. There isn't really a way to completely avoid it and still live in society. But how do we live with these choices? What I like about this episode so much is how much it humanizes this sidekick character. He's made vulnerable but not weak. He makes a choice first to hide, then later to take action. But this isn't a contradiction, but rather Skanky taking responsibility for his choices and changing as the situation evolves. Secondly, I wanted to make a quick point about Nick, who is, after all, our usual topic of conversation. Often Nick is caught between his identity as a vampire and his longed-for state as a human, although I have previously questioned how much he really wants this to change. Nick is perpetually in bad faith, it seems, always acting in ways that are in accordance with what one does in a certain situation, regardless of his natural instincts. But for now, let's get back to the show. We cut to a cluttered and dirty room. A man in silhouette is making a phone call to check on an ad he ran in a newspaper. His name that he gives the paper is Alan Smithy, which, if you know what that is and how it relates to cinema, is a little bit funny. The ad is going to run that night. He turns to the camera, and it's the computer repair guy from earlier, I think. I didn't get a great look at his face before, honestly. So, to get a little bit ahead in the episode, it is the computer repair guy who turns out to be the killer. I'll explain why later on. But honestly, when we had the dramatic reveal in the scene, I didn't get it at first. I didn't recognize him, and I didn't understand who it was supposed to be. It was only in retrospect that I put the pieces together. Maybe that's my fault. Maybe I should have been paying more attention at the beginning. But honestly, like, I didn't see where in the episode we were supposed to make note of this man's face. He barely had any sort of speaking role. He was just kind of a minor character talking to Norma. So anyway, the significance of who he was almost went right past me the first time I watched it. At the end of the scene, we cut to commercial, and when we come back, we're in Stonetree's office. Nick is reporting in. He doesn't think it's any perp that Donnie or Jimmy had taken in during their time together. Nick wants internal affairs to dig into the angle that it was a cop. Nick leaves the office. Norma comes into the office with a ream of computer printouts. She closes the door after Nick leaves. She's telling Stonetree that there's a problem. According to the police database, Officer Knight doesn't exist. Nick is out in the office area, but he's listening in with his vampire super hearing. Nick calls Jeanette and asks about someone named Larry Merlin. We cut to the lair. There's a slow pan across the space. There's inexplicable motorcycle in the foreground. I mean, at this rate, I'm gonna have to stop calling it that. There's some weird camera angles sweeping past Nick, who's at the piano, and then up into the air, and we start to hear lines of dialogue from previous points in the episode. And oh my god, we better not be getting another montage. But no, it's just a long panning shot of Nick being super moody under audio clips from the show. Finally, we cut to the computer tech guy. There's guns on the wall of his room and a shirt that says Army, and he's loading a weapon. We cut back to Nick, and music is still playing, but it's still not quite a montage. We get some nice driving shots of the city, some really nice shots of the Cadillac, Nick in the nighttime. So the music is not The Night Calls My Name, but it does sound like the same singer. So it's not a montage like we've had before. It's just kind of an elongated scene of driving and shots of Toronto, the end result of which is really just to get us, the viewers, and Nick back to the Raven. It's weird and seems very much out of place. Inside the Raven, Skanky is being boring to some chick by rambling at her. Nick is talking to a man, Larry, I presume, about his problem with the computer system. He has to create his identity along with documents to back up every single aspect of it: birth records, medical records, school reports, previous work history. It's going to take time and money. Skanky hears the tail end of the conversation, but not the context. Side note. So, Nick establishing a thorough background with documentation is a little B plot in this episode. But he's been in Toronto for 3 years. He's been a detective for like 1.5 to 2 years. So, I mean, does the city of Toronto just hire anyone as a police detective without any background checks? How the hell did he become a detective without all that stuff already in place? I could see some details missing, health records maybe. But I assume, as a vampire in the late 20th century, Nick has had to get birth certificates and driver's licenses and other kinds of ID. We know from previous episodes he worked and lived in Chicago at some point. So, does Nick have a social security card? The whole subplot just raises a ton of questions for me. Skanky wants to get out of the Raven and he confronts Nick about it, but Nick talks him down. And again, it's just a nice scene. Skanky is scared and he's anxious, but he's not unreasonable. Nick leaves. We cut to ominous guy in the alley. Back in the Raven, Skanky decides to take a walk to the newspaper stand to at least get something to read. Jeanette tries to stop him, but he swears to return right away, and she relents, and it's not like she really gives a fuck about him anyway. At the stand, Donnie's flipping through the newspaper talking to the vendor when he sees a classified ad to Donut Don. It says it's time to take a trip down memory lane, or he, the writer, is going hunting at the cottage up north. So, the cottage up north is where Skanky's wife and daughter are staying. So I'm thinking, oh shit, the killer's gonna target Skanky's family. Skanky runs away and commandeers a car and takes off. By the way, just to make a point of it here, the fact that Skanky reads this specific newspaper every week was set up earlier in the episode, so it's not totally random that he happened to see this ad. We cut to Jeanette on the phone telling Nick that Skanky is gone about 15 minutes ago. We cut again to somewhere. Skanky hops out of the car and pulls his gun. This doesn't look like the countryside, and these buildings don't look like cottages, so I don't know where they are. A door flips open suddenly, and a man is there. Donnie shoots, but it's just a cardboard cutout. A couple shots hit near Skanky's feet, and he dives for cover. A voice emanating over a loudspeaker laughs and calls him Donut. Remember, we've established that the bad guy is a marksman, so the missed shots are intentional. We cut to Nick and his caddy, and he's questioning the newsstand lady. Obviously, he figures out about the ad. Skanky is talking at the killer back at wherever he is. He tries to move. He gets shot in the arm, not fatally. The editing in the scene is actually really good. I'm sure I'm not doing it justice. We're in the caddy again, and Nick is on the radio with Stonetree, who's on his office phone. And he's informing Nick that at the academy training course, the gun training course is called Memory Lane. Okay, so this was a misdirect. I obviously thought the killer was going to the cottage where Skanky's family was, but this was a reference that cops would get. So that's a clue. Nick stops driving and starts flying. At the shooting course, Skanky is trying to stop the bleeding on his arm. The killer is mocking him over his poor performance at the academy. So the setup here is honestly a little bit dumb, but the scene itself is pretty good. So let me just tell you what we learn in the exchange of dialogue. Skanky and Jimmy went to the academy together, but were not great students. But obviously they passed and got to be cops. Now, the killer was in the same class, but didn't make it through the academy, even though he thinks he was much better. And obviously, when it comes to the shooting part, he was. Donnie figures out the killer's name, McAvoy, who he remembers at the academy being a real nutbar who got dropped from the academy due to failing the psych exam. McAvoy points out times when people died on Skanky's watch. And he's implying, I guess, that they would not have died had McAvoy been a cop. So yes, McAvoy is indeed the computer repair guy we saw at the station before. After leaving the academy, he went into computers and was actually very successful. However, he recently was passed up for a promotion, which pissed him off. When he was working on the police computer system, he saw that Jimmy was about to be promoted and McAvoy decided to kill him. Okay, sure, why not? I mean, it all seems like a really sudden and convenient motive, but the scene is still well done, and it's actually well acted, and the editing is really good, providing a nice sense of tension, and we really get sort of caught up in the cat and mouse of Skanky moving through the training course, while these cardboard cutouts pop up, and Skanky has to decide whether or not to shoot. So the scene overall is good, which is good because the plot as revealed is a little bit lame, as I hope I've explained. So anyway, Nick arrives on the scene and he immediately has a flashback. Jeanette and Lacroix escaped into some trapdoor in the shack. Okay, sure. But Nick refuses to go with him. There's one more vampire hunter, and Nick is going to kill him. Back at the training grounds, the cat and mouse game continues. In the flashback, the last hunter comes into the shack with a cross and seems to have Nick cornered. But Lacroix punches through the floor and grabs his foot like a good horror movie, allowing Nick to go in for the kill. McAvoy gets the drop on Skanky, but Nick calls out, distracting him, and Donnie gets a shot off, taking him down. And that brings us to wrap-up time. Back at the station, Norma is perplexed, but Nick suddenly has a full and complete record on their mainframe now. Thanks to Larry Merlin, I presume. Nick walks in, and Stonetree quickly shouts out, "Hey Nick, where were you born?"
Chicago, he says.
Okay. So, Nick Knight is American? Does he have Canadian citizenship? He offers that his birth date was 1957, but Norma corrects him, 1958. Oh yeah, New Year's Day, Nick says. Stonetree laughs it off, but Norma doesn't look convinced. Hey Nick, maybe you don't volunteer information? This, of course, gives us some backstory from Nick. His current identity of Nicholas Knight was born in Chicago on January 1st, 1958, making his persona 34 years old. I was curious if that was the actor's real age, so I looked it up, and Gerontwin Davies was born in April 1957, so, you know, ballpark.
Skanky and Nick talk at the station. Donnie's on desk duty until his arm heals. There was actually a running theme in the episode I didn't bring up about Skanky knowing a lot about opera music. And this is paid off with Nick learning a bit about Skanky being a music buff. Opera, jazz, rock, classical. And it's nice. It's a really good humanization of Donnie. I dig it. There's a bit of dialogue and bonding between the two, and it's really nice. It's a good, genuine moment between friends. And that's the end of the episode. So let's consider what we've learned about Don Skanky. Dostoevsky writes, quote, "If God did not exist, everything would be permitted," end quote. Sartre writes that this is the starting point for existentialism. Without God, man is forlorn. He can only depend on himself. There are no excuses. There's no external thing to point a finger at to either blame or take credit for our choices. There's no determinism. Man is freedom. In this episode, Skanky finds himself forced to make decisions of life and death for himself and his family. He loses his friend and is driven to seek vengeance, but this drive is tempered by considering what is best for his family and himself. We see him suffering the consequences of his choices, feeling trapped, feeling weak, but accepting the sacrifice of his ego for the greater good. We see him spring into action when he can be pushed no further. In essence, we see Don Skanky as a reflection of an everyman, both consciously deciding his fate at some times and giving himself over to circumstances at others. He lives the best he can with the knowledge and situations that he encounters. He does what he thinks is the best thing to do until the situation changes and he adapts. He is neither wholly aware of his existentialist freedom and his responsibility, nor is he wholly in bad faith. He is human. He is freedom. He is Don Skanky. So, my thoughts and impressions on this episode. I really liked it, and it was directed really well. Lots of camera movement, better pacing and blocking of the characters, moving us from one scene to the next with dialogue and continued motion. It just looked good. It was grounded, and Skanky was on a quest and well-written for a change. Fucking fantastic. Now, the sudden slowdown in the middle for minutes of a time of panning across the lair and driving scenes across the city, that was a bit perplexing. But that aside, this episode was really good. So everyone, where does that take us for next time? Up next is episode 12 of season 1, entitled Dead Issue. And it seems it will give us a bit more on Captain Stonetree, so I'm definitely looking forward to that. Also, this brings us to the midway point of season 1. We are halfway through the first season. Wow. Not that I thought I'd quit doing the podcast or anything, but I have to admit, after episodes like Dance by the Light of the Moon, number 5, I was really starting to wonder if the show had any legs for me to stand on. But now I gotta say, I'm really glad I'm doing this. We're slowly getting Nick's life and character revealed to us. The nature of vampire society centered around Jeanette and the Raven is gradually being expanded upon. And now even Skanky is getting some humanization and grounding. To be completely honest, I'd have to describe the series so far as uneven. It's a real mix of quality in terms of writing, acting, and directing. But man, when it's good, it's really good. And when it's not, well, at least we have our montages to soothe us. Until next time, gentle listener, thank you for your kind attention to Still Dreaming, an existentialist wandering through our forever night. Do you want to connect with Still Dreaming? You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and on Twitter at podcast_still. And we have a group on Facebook. Just look up Still Dreaming Podcast. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreamingpodcast.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.